Hello and welcome to the St. Andrews Society of Los Angeles podcast. Each episode will bring you the latest news from the St. Andrews Society of Los Angeles, as well as fascinating interviews with entertainment personalities, government leaders, and community advocates. St. Andrews Society of Los Angeles, where Scotland meets the City of Angels. Let's get started. Hello and welcome to the St. Andrews Society of Los Angeles. Our guest today is Nobel laureate Dr. Richard Henderson, who was born in Edinburgh, Scotland, and is a renowned molecular biologist and biophysicist and the pioneer in the field of electron microscopy of biological molecules. He studied physics at the University of Edinburgh and went on to Cambridge, where he received his PhD. His interest in membrane proteins led him to working as a postdoctoral researcher at Yale University. Returning to the MRC Lab of Molecular Biology at Cambridge, Dr. Henderson continues his hands-on research where techniques he developed are still in use to this day. In 2017, Dr. Henderson was awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. We're fortunate and honored to have one of the world's foremost authorities in molecular biology today. Our guest interviewer is David Warburton, who was born and medically educated in London at Harvard and Brown. His major contributions range from clinical studies establishing management practices of extreme prematurity to infants of organ repair and regeneration. Dr. Warburton periodically gives keynote presentations at major U.S. and world scientific meetings, as well as teaching in Liverpool, Cardiff, Birmingham, and London. David is a past trustee and past vice president of the St. Andrews Society of Los Angeles.
I've very much enjoyed reading your biography on the Nobel website. It was very interesting. I see that you were actually made in England but born in Scotland. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, actually, I think none of us moved out of Scotland till we're nearly 20 years old. You know, we did within 50 miles of where we were being brought up. Yeah. We did, you know, aged about 19, I think, I made my first expedition into England. Although we lived on the border, actually. And of course, we did walk across the border occasionally. Right. But down to London, not till a bit later.
Like me, you were a product of the 1946 Educational Act of Rab Butler, in that we all got free education and we got scholarships and things like that. So I guess you started out, really a formative thing was in Hoyk, wasn't it, at the high school in Hoyk?
Yeah, no, I had two primary schools and two secondary schools, and Hoyk High School was the first time we were exposed to, you know, good teaching in a variety of subjects, science, Latin, French, and so on. Whereas before, it was a small village school. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was the benefits of the Educational Act. And I remember when I was about 15, which was the actual official leaving age under the Butler Act, at that point, in order to encourage people to stay on at school, my parents received a special grant of £50 a year. Yes. So that they didn't try to persuade me to leave school and start work to earn money for the family. And that obviously was brought in to try and broaden the educational base, because not a lot of people stayed on in higher education in those days.
Well, it was very smart. I mean, that was about £5,000 in today's money. And, of course, intelligence is widely distributed across the population, and it was a very clever thing to extract the smart people from obscurity and bring them forward. And we weren't the only people to think of that. The Russians did it as well. So, yeah. So you got entranced with physics, I guess, at school with your teacher, Bilko, right?
Yeah, Bill Cow. Yeah, he was in Bilko. Yeah, they called him like almost like Sergeant Bilko in the American soap.
I know that's where it came from. Yeah,
I mean, I think until I got in Hoyk, where I went to high school for 5 years, we just had one teacher who taught us science. And the exam in the Scottish Higher equivalent to the English A-levels, it must be an American equivalent. It was just science. There was no real distinction between chemistry and physics. But when I got to, for 1 year, to a sort of slightly better school in Edinburgh at Boroughmuir, we had separate teachers that were for physics, for chemistry, for biology, for, you know, engineering and so on. So, you know, at each stage, and this is just, you know, fortuitous for me, each time I moved from school, it was slightly better, and you definitely had the impression of making progress. But physics was Bill Cow.
Yeah.
And he's the one who was quite enthusiastic about biophysics, actually. Yeah. And he's the one who he did in one lesson, you know, in high school. We didn't have any exams to do. It was the final year. We'd already done our exams.
Right.
He actually recorded a lecture given by one of the university lecturers in biophysics in Edinburgh University called Jack Dainty. And Dainty himself, I never met, but he's the one, they wouldn't promote him from being a reader to being a professor. So he left and went to Norwich, and then he went from Norwich to Canada. And then, of course, he died 10 or 20 years ago.
Well, in those days, of course, it was a zero-sum game. I mean, you know, a professor had to die for you to be made a professor, right?
Yeah.
It's not like in America where we create professors and there's it's not
limited. Now, that's what they followed the American lead now, and so now they have lots and lots of professors. Yeah. And actually, people are trying to avoid becoming the head of department now because it's a lot of work that's largely thankless.
Yes, exactly. Not very interesting. So then you went to Edinburgh and then you hightailed it to Cambridge. Well, I guess you did some other things, some other interesting things, didn't you? I mean, you worked at Ferranti or somewhere, didn't you? Working in the was that a summer job?
Yeah, I think. I mean, partly it was to earn money every time in the holidays, Christmas, Easter, summer holidays. I always had jobs, and partly it was to just earn money in order to, for example, run a car, have the expense of running a car so you could drive around independently. But also partly it was actually to gain experience. So the Ferranti was certainly to find out how science in industry worked. And other jobs, I had one summer in the physics department at Edinburgh, which turned out to be the best summer job, which, you know, convinced me then that physics is a good idea. But I also spent 8 weeks one summer working in the UK Atomic Energy at Aldermaston, which was the UK Atomic Weapons Research Establishment. And so I had to be given security clearance to do that. So a really ex-army guy, you know, with a very big moustache and a beard, in an open-top sports car with a bloodhound in the passenger seat, interview me.
Must have been
to make sure I wasn't a communist, you know, and would be, you know, letting loose the secrets from atomic weapons. And the best story from that visit, you know, he interviewed me, he interviewed my friends. They were looking at. He interviewed my father, who had relatively restricted interest, and he said, this ex-army guy, he said, "Did you know that your son was an atheist?" And my father said, "What is an atheist?" Another brilliant, brilliant answer.
Great working class answer, yes.
It was, actually, yeah.
Well, presumably your father must have been pretty bright. I mean, actually, and your mother extremely bright.
My father was just an ordinary guy, actually. He wasn't very, you know, I remember having a number of discussions with him, and he sometimes couldn't understand things. So he was a real hard worker, a really nice man. But my mother was the one that had the more academic background and interest. And she really regretted having had to leave school when she was 14, because it was in 1930. Yeah. It would be the Depression. Her father was out of work for 10 years, and she and her mother were the ones who brought in money for the family in those days, actually. And so as a result, she was always very interested in education and quite happy to to be supportive and encourage me to continue. Whereas other contemporaries of mine from that age, a lot of them left school age 15 to get a job to help the family, whereas I was not directly encouraged, but certainly not restricted in having an ambition to carry on. And so my mum was the main one. My father was kind of a relatively low-key supportive, but not overtly so.
Right. Well, one didn't show emotion in those days.
That's true. No. Yeah. And also, I think, you know, the men who were working, the jobs they did, they had to work very hard and they were tired. So my father was a baker of bread and cakes. And when he came home, we said, look, you're a baker, you know. So wouldn't you like to make us some really nice cakes at home? He said, no. He said, I've been baking all day. Okay. I'm not going to do baking.
Forget that, yeah.
So he would study the newspaper, and I think he had an interest in horse racing, actually. He always felt he could make money by betting on them. And I always felt he just about broke even. Yeah,
well, that's right. Well, all those towers in Las Vegas weren't built with nothing, were they? You said somewhere that you liked metalwork, which turned out to be very useful for you later in life. Did they teach metalwork at Hoyt?
Yes. So, well, it was called technical subjects, and we all did that at the beginning. At the beginning of this year, they weren't making you be purely academic. That whole class, obviously, you know, the boys did technical subjects, which would be either woodwork or metalwork, and then you had to do technical drawing and a bit of maths that went with it. The girls did home care, cooking and things like this. So when we went home after school on the day that we did that subject, the girls would all be armed with the edible
the goodies.
Delicacies that they'd done. And we had to eat them. And some of them were quite good. Some of them weren't so good, actually. But yeah, but in our case, I learned for 5 or 6 years, a lot of what you might need if you went into a design technology company. And that is quite useful. So we still do metalwork. And so now when we have instrumentation built in science, it's quite useful to be able to, you know, look at the diagrams and make your own, even sketches, you know, if you had 6 years of experience sitting exams and so on, it is quite useful. And so I think it would be useful now, if there wasn't quite so much specialization and everybody was allowed to do some hands-on practical work as well as sort of brain work and reading and writing.
Yes, I agree with you. I mean, my father actually taught woodwork, metalwork and mechanical drawing at a grammar school down in Hackney, actually. The grocer's company school, yeah. So you were talking about instrumentation. I mean, One of the features of your career has been that instrumentation has been really important, because having the microscope that can see what you want to see is like really key in discovering things, especially at the molecular level.
Not everybody was so interested in hands-on work, actually. Some people were more theoretical. Some people like writing articles. I think I've got some marks on the people in this group as well. So there was one from Hoyt and five from Boroughmuir in that one physics class in Edinburgh. So nobody had the slightest interest in going anywhere other than to their nearest university. So I remember in Boroughmuir, which is still a really good school in Edinburgh, they asked us at the beginning of our final year, would anybody have any interest in going to Oxford or Cambridge? You know, they are good universities. And we all said, no, we want to go to Edinburgh, Glasgow, some of people. But one guy in our class in Boroughmuir, who was a Latin and Greek scholar, and he was the school, what they called the ducks. He got the prize for being top pupil in the hall. He decided he would like to apply to Cambridge, but they turned him down. So as far as I know, Cambridge never took anybody from our school at the undergraduate level. I came to Cambridge when I was, must be 21, something like that, which would be a couple of weeks after my 21st birthday. And they actually said, you know, why didn't you come earlier? And I said, well, I was I was working in Edinburgh for Murchie's Dairy, delivering yogurt, milk, and dairy produce all over Scotland. And these summer jobs were quite interesting, actually. What they did is they hired students from university because they could learn things quickly,
Right.
and then they would give you a couple of weeks following somebody round all over Scotland. Every day you'd go to a different place and visit a different shop, and then the person who was in the summer on holiday, you then took over, and you had to go around Scotland
Oh, really?
where you'd been once before to visit all the same shops, actually. And then, of course, you'd get a few turns wrong, but the next week you had to do the same thing again, and you'd make the same wrong turn, actually. So anyway, I did get to Cambridge, and I've been here, apart from 3 years at Yale, ever since. And but this lab where I am, it is a very good lab, and I almost didn't find it because I decided to go from physics into some specialization of it, including particularly biophysics. And I looked all over the UK. I didn't want to go to America to do a PhD because they forced you to do another year or two of exams, and I had enough of exams by that point. Anyway, I did find three or four places in the UK that did biophysics, which would be Oxford, London, Leeds. And then this guy, Jack Dainty, who'd given this lecture that I heard when I was at school, he had by then moved to Norwich. But when I wrote to them, they said, "Oh, we don't let you do a PhD immediately. You have to do another year of MSc courses and exams." So I said, "No, I'm not going to do that." So I, in the end, decided I would, my initial decision was to go to King's College in London, which is where Maurice Wilkins, who'd worked done DNA X-ray diffraction, taking over from Rosalind Franklin. But when I got back to Edinburgh, having done all those little research to investigate where you could do biophysics in Britain, I thought I'd better tell our professor in Edinburgh, physics, Bill Cochrane. And he said, "Oh, King's College." He said, "No," he said, "you must write to my friend and colleague Perutz in Cambridge." And in physics in Edinburgh, I hadn't heard of Medical Research Council, Perutz, biophysics, but it was very good advice. So when I actually came to visit this lab here, where I am, the same one I am at the moment, I'd visited King's College in London on a Wednesday all day, had really good discussions, but by about 5 o'clock, they'd all disappeared, and I was nearly the only one left in the department at five. Whereas I came to Cambridge to this lab on a Saturday morning, and everyone's working. So I thought, well, these people are highly motivated, beavering away, working on the weekends, whereas King's was quite sophisticated, but they weren't so highly motivated about their work. So I changed my choice from King's to come in Cambridge. And it's still a very good lab. So I've, there are always opportunities, but I've never moved from here. And now I'm a sort of semi-emeritus, so but
Yes,
still here.
I'll ask you about that. I mean, you still have your so you're sort of you still paid, or are they not paying you anymore?
Well, I did spend 10 years being the head of the lab.
Yeah, well, then
And
you built it as well, didn't you?
that was my duty.
You built
But when I sort of stepped down, that was before the official retirement age is still supposed to be 65. So when I reached 65, I said I would like to carry on being able to do experiments myself, possibly collaborating with one or two people. And I didn't want to be paid. And then they said, "Well, I'm terribly sorry, you cannot be paid zero. As long as you still have some responsibilities for looking after other people." I think
Right.
they wanted to have some kind of hope. So I said, "Okay, think of the smallest sum of money you can pay me." And they thought of 2.5 hours a week. So I get paid 2.5 hours a week,
Wow. Sounds
but
like
I still
disadvantage.
work.
It
It's
sounds
not
like
really work.
disadvantage.
What
Yeah.
we do isn't really work. It's kind of a paid hobby.
I
So
know.
I still work 60 or 70 hours.
I know. I tell people I've never worked a day in my life.
Exactly. exactly the same.
It's the same, isn't it? Yeah.
No, no, but it's different if you have patients, because
Well, that's fun too, but yeah. So I think that some of the people would like to know something about what molecular biology is. I mean, you've studied the structure of molecules, and you've been able to isolate single molecules and put them in an electron microscope and get an actual photograph of the atomic structure of molecules. Would you like to just tell us why you think that's important and why the Nobel people thought that was important?
Yeah. Well, I guess, initially my thought coming from physics was just to get into biophysics. Mm. It wasn't necessarily to work on the structure of biological molecules. It just so happened when I arrived here in this lab, one of the possible projects was with what was my then PhD supervisor. And so I worked on an enzyme from the gut called chymotrypsin. It was about the third or fourth protein structure known ever. But when I started, it wasn't known. And in the end, I was sort of drafted in as a helper with that project. So my first paper, which was after about a year of being a PhD student, was helping them to find out the structure of chymotrypsin. So then after that, I thought, well, thousands of molecules in biology. You can spend your entire life working them out. But the guy I went to work with as a postdoctoral student at Yale, who was a Chinese-American called Ray Wong, he said, when you're young, you shouldn't just look at the next step. You should look 20 years ahead and pick something that will come to fruition in the more distant future. So I switched from working on soluble proteins, enzymes, to being interested in membrane proteins. And then it turned out that was very difficult. So that changed my emphasis from using X-ray diffraction as a tool to determine the structure of the molecules to using electron microscopy. And then it turned out that it was still in its infancy. So we made lots of sort of incremental improvements and turned the electron microscopy method from being something that gave you low resolution images, was very time consuming, very tedious, into one that's quite quick, quite productive, and really quite powerful. And so I think that the Nobel people cited work we did about 1990, which was to determine the structure of a membrane protein. It wasn't the first membrane protein. That was done by Hartmut Nickel and people in Martinsried in Germany, and they got a Nobel Prize in 1988 for that. Mm-hmm. And our structure, which was the second membrane protein structure, didn't come out till 1990, but it was done by a completely different method using electrons instead of X-rays. And so that was the first really high resolution biological structure to be done using electron microscopy, electron diffraction. But then, of course, the method continued to develop, and now every year, there are thousands and thousands of structures determined by electron microscopy, alongside thousands that are still being determined by X-ray crystallography. And now in the data bank, instead of in 1966, say, there would be only two protein structures known, and the work I started would be the third or fourth one. Now there's 200,000 in the database. And so in a way, biology's gone from knowing a little bit to knowing an enormous amount about all the structures, all the drug targets, all the molecules that go wrong in disease. So it really is a golden era now compared to what it was. It was being rapidly developing then, but now it's really relatively mature, but with further improvements coming up in the years ahead. So it's quite a powerful and productive method that lots of people in cell biology and medicine now simply use structural biology as one of the tools in their work.
It would be lovely to be 21 again and have all these tools, wouldn't it? So I remember at St. Thomas's Hospital being shown the electron micrograph of the coronavirus in about 1968. It was discovered in 64.
Yeah.
The lady who discovered it was a Scot from Glasgow. Uh-huh. She was the daughter of a milkman or something. And I remember her saying, "Oh, it looks just like the honours of Scotland, and that's why I've called it coronavirus."
All right, I didn't know that. That's very interesting.
Yes, I'm sorry, I forgot her name. It's a terrible, but Yes. So, I mean, there it was, the circle with the little jewels on it, you know, which were the ACE receptor binding proteins or something.
Yeah, it would be. It would be the spike protein that's now the target for both vaccinations. And there are lots of people now developing what could be antiviral drugs, that some of them could be binding to the spike protein. They could be inhibiting the RNA polymerase, or they could be, there is a, actually inside the coronavirus, there are a couple of proteases that cleave up the different proteins that are part of its life cycle. And one of them actually, which is the major protease of coronavirus, is a homologous protein to the chymotrypsin structure that I worked on when I was a student. But there isn't yet a really good, highly specific antiviral drug that would block that protease, but lots of companies are working on that. So actually, there is a lot of common ground and a lot of cross-fertilization between structural biology, cell biology, medicine, virology, and you know, curing human diseases. Quite interesting.
Well, evolution was done by a committee, wasn't it? I mean, basically, evolution is dead lazy. And once you have one structure, it gets reused for many different things. So the homology is not surprising.
Pick them all up. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I just wanted to show this picture that just went off the screen a moment ago. But lovely picture of your family here in the that's in the City Hall, isn't it? In Stockholm.
They take you to the evening dress shop, hire shop in Stockholm to make sure you've got the right outfit. You have to pay for it, and it has the Swedes organize it. Yeah,
the Swedish style.
And also, the three other men. So on the very left is our oldest grandson, Josh, who's now probably 26. He has one of the same white tie and tails. And then just behind me in the middle is my son, who's now 48 or something like that. He's got his white tie and tails on. And then the youngest grandson is Tom, who's about to do his GCSE. He's got his white tail and white tie and tails on as well. And then all the girls were competing to have the best dress. So they have to pick their own, actually. Yeah. But yeah, they were all, I mean, quite a few of them, they said, I'm not sure I can come to Stockholm. The school won't let me come. Said, of course. They had to ask permission, and of course they all said, "Of course you can go." You know, it was great fun. Yeah. And then the youngest girl, who was fourth from the left, who was called Rosie, mm-hmm. who just got her A level results yesterday, because she now lives in Lincolnshire. Mm-hmm. She is the one who told her chemistry teacher that her granddad had a Nobel Prize. So then I had to go to visit Rosie and her chemistry teacher in their school in Lincolnshire. And then having done that, of course, had to go to other schools. So I've done a few visits to schools in Cambridge and then where the grandchildren go as well, as part of the outreach of the Nobel Foundation, who try to encourage people to do all that sort of thing.
And talking to the kids, what are some of the questions that they ask you when you're lecturing with them? Because this has got to be completely new to them.
It is new to them, but actually, you know, I don't think they're so, you know, they do teach about DNA, RNA and protein in schools, but not at such a high level. They need that to be at university. So I think, you know, I can't think of any, I mean, they ask questions about general science, you know, about, for example, at the same Nobel year, they did have the physics Nobel Prize for the gravitational wave discovery. And of course that, compared to what we do, we're just doing the structures of a few biological molecules using a different method. And 10 years from now, the methods will be improved. But gravitational waves didn't exist, or at least they were speculated, but hadn't been measured until 2015 or so, and the Nobel Prize 2017 was. So actually a lot of the schools ask questions, and also in the lecture theatre where they had the Nobel Prize lectures, they said It holds 1,200 or 1,300. It's a very big lecture theatre. And we asked, do you have to have tickets? They said, oh, no. It said, it's never been full. The lecture theatre has never been full because there are not enough people in Stockholm to fill it that are interested to go. But for the physics Nobel Prize lectures, which were the first ones to be given on that particular day, it was too full, and they had to say, we can't have the lectures because the fire regulations prohibit us from having more than, and so they had to kick out 30 people before they could start to do the physics Nobel Prize. And then by the time they got from physics to chemistry to biology, it wasn't quite full again. So a lot of the school children were asking questions about, space travel, the universe, and gravitational waves. So those are still, and now they've got hundreds of examples of these gravitational waves, and it's going to get better because they've got new systems being built. So that actually is really quite an interesting part of science at the moment.
So would you have worn the kilt if you had had the option?
Well, the trouble is I don't have a kilt.
I was wondering if you had one or not. Yes.
I know I had one when I was three. And yeah. I wore it when I was three. And I have a picture of my brother when he was six wearing the kilt. But the thing is, kilts for very small children don't cost much. So when we got bigger, we never had any kilts. And actually, I haven't worn one since I was about three or four. But at that same Nobel Prize ceremony, Alistair MacDowall, who's another Scot who worked with Dubochet, and he was there as a guest. He came in his full regalia. He had the sash, and the sporran, and the kilt. So we have great pictures of Alistair MacDowall with us. Do you have a favorite book?
Right. And it can't be the Bible or Shakespeare.
Definitely not. No, I wouldn't bother to read. No, actually, that was my first experience at high school. We began with Shakespeare, and it was a complete revelation to me, actually. Right. No, we began with Chaucer, and then we moved on to Shakespeare a little bit later on, actually. No, but there are new books that have been written that it may be that you've read them or that other people in St. Andrew's Society have read them, but the two that have come recently that I think are very good are both semi-scientific, but they're written by historians. And historians have a much broader view of civilization and the development of the world and so on. So one of them is called What on Earth Happened by a historian called Christopher Lloyd. It was published about 10 years ago. And it begins with the Big Bang 13.5 billion years ago and passes through. So what on Earth happened? It's about the Earth, but it's about the complete history of it from the beginning of time. And then the other one is called Sapiens, which you may have known also, by Yuval Harari, who's an Israeli historian. And his great thing is, it's 400 or 500 pages. It's about mainly about human civilization, but it begins on the first page. He said, in the beginning, there's the Big Bang, where you have, electrons and nuclei moving around. We call this physics. And then it said, as the temperature of the world decreased, and atoms began to form and then formed into pairs. We call that chemistry. And then as it cooled a bit further and they became better ordered, you got elementary life forms. We call that biology. And that's all in the first half page. And then he moves on to, animals and humanity for the other 450. So these are both books that give the reader a complete view of the entire development of the universe from the beginning of time right up to the current. And then a lot of it is about the current time. So I think these two are really interesting books, actually. So I remember being so keen on it, I thought I'd buy a few and leave them lying around. And when the children and grandchildren came, they said, oh, what is this enormously thick book? And they always took it away to read themselves. So I think these would be both good ones, to mention to people in the St. Andrew's Society. And actually, they kind of follow on from when I was at university, they had one or two little prizes. There was one called the Neil Arnott prize, which was 30, you got £30. And in return for that, you had to teach 3 hours a week for the entire year, 30, so 30 weeks times, so 90 hours, and you got a prize of £30 for doing that. But Neil Arnott, turns out, he was a Scottish physician, a medical man, but he was interested in everything. And so he wrote a book about 1850 called The Elements of Physics. So it was a doctor writing a book about physics, and he tried to get everything in physics down into one volume. So it's a bit like the Christopher Lloyd or the Harari books nowadays, but he was doing it in 1850. And then, of course, physics was developing at a hell of a pace, and his writing wasn't, because he was a doctor, he was in the Royal Society and so on. He was a scientist. He kept writing books, volume two, volume three. And then in the end, he gave up because the pace of development was too quick for him. And you can get facsimile versions of his Elements of Physics still. Just you go to eBay and you can buy them. So these two books from modern historians about science and these very old books, I think, are quite interesting. So this is kind of like, if people want to follow up on what they hear on podcasts, this would be an interesting activity for them. Joanna, that could be your evening reading.
Yes, actually, I need a new book, so this might be something that I go and pick up. But that you brought up kind of an interesting topic with science, just science in general, but just kind of the various aspects of it, and especially with these two books, combining science and history with that. How does that work for somebody who's not kind of analytical like that? Do you find that people who can take a scientific thought and then move it into something that they understand, like history or like sociology, do you find that they gravitate back towards science once they've found kind of that common thread that they personally are attracted to?
I think maybe, maybe the scientists or the people who try to write articles about it, they try to define it somewhat separately. But I have to say, I don't, we do say we are scientists and we do research, we find out new things. But I don't see much difference between that and just trying to figure out, let's say, 200, 300 years ago, scientists were not labeled scientists. People were still trying to find out how the world worked. They're trying to use common sense. So I think there's a continuum. You're just trying to find out the truth and to find out knowledge. And so I think you want to try and break down the barriers between scientists and non-scientists by encouraging them just to think of it as a continuum of common sense and knowledge. And the problem at the moment, I think the great thing about the modern world, I mean, 40 years ago, there wasn't much science in the newspapers. It was full of opinion articles or the media and so on. But now, I think it's partly from computers and smartphones, the newspapers and the TV programs are now full of really good programs about medicine, health, nutrition, viruses, cosmology, the planets, all the, the Sputnik, the space station and Mars and Jupiter, all these probes has brought scientific things into the normal world of everyday life. And so I think unless people put their head in the sand, they're going to be exposed to this all the time, actually. And I think that the problem now with the internet, I think it'll change though, is that people get themselves partly by, Facebook and so on, they get themselves into little corners. I don't see such a big divide between science and everybody else. I think it's just a big pool of knowledge that you're trying to glean, and that where it has an impact on people, of course, is where you get science to economics to jobs to livelihood to being able to make your way in the world. And in a way, you want this to become a continuum rather than to have it demarcated. So anyway, that's.
No, that's great. Thank you.
So we're almost up to the hour. So I'm going to ask you the last question on the list. So the St. Andrew Society of Los Angeles promotes Scottish culture, innovation, business, people, and so on. And drawing upon the rich history of your country of birth, Scotland, do you think there's anything that one can do or that we can do to promote the important work of science in this sphere?
Well, yeah, as I was saying, I would go for science as a branch of general knowledge about the behavior of people. You know, so economics is to do more with psychology rather than the rules of science. But I think in the St. Andrews Society, I would carry on, you know, we still have here in Cambridge, all over the world, we have Burns Night with Rabbi Burns, who wasn't particularly scientific. But I think having that as a sort of focal point, and then getting local scientists in the Los Angeles area to do face-to-face presentations is a good idea. And then keeping an eye on the latest frontiers, for example, the gravitational waves is quite a good thing. And these two or three books I mentioned are quite good windows into a broader world of that. But in the, you know, in the Los Angeles area, there are lots of local people that you can tap into, as well as people that are further afield, actually. So I would just encourage you to carry on and, you know, wave the flag and, you know, mention. But, you know, Scotland isn't one of the other questions was, you know, is there anything special about Scotland? It's only 5 million people here at the moment. And, you know, the great contribution of Scotland to the world has been exporting people that have had a high value attached to education, not just scientific education, but generally broad education. And so the country, you know, 5 million, it's not big enough to make a big impact. And although, you know, we're proud of Scotland and there've been lots of individual contributions, the country isn't really big enough to have a dominant influence. So I think you have to work with other people, be part of, and I think people in Scotland were very keen to be part of Europe, although we've got Brexit at the moment, that's likely to be reversed. The scientists don't pay any attention to it. But there have been points in the past where there has been a Scottish ambition to be more dominant, and it hasn't always worked. For example, I'm sure you know about the Darien disaster, where Scotland tried to make a colony in Panama, which was a swamp, mosquito-infested swamp, and it was a total disaster in something like 1690 or something like that. And it was eventually that bankruptcy of Scotland was rescued by the Union of the Crowns and so on in
London,
1707, yeah. Something like that. So there are really good sides to Scotland, but it's also good to remember the bad sides and look forward to more interaction and more interplay with people from the rest of the world, actually. But it's a great thing to have a focus. So you have your historical heritage, but you also look forward as well as looking back.
I think that's a wonderful place to end. And thank you so much, Richard. It's been a lot of fun. If I'm ever in the UK, I will look you up and came.
Please, yeah, be great.
Before I let you go, is there a website that if people are interested in you, interested in science, interested in the Nobel Prize, hearing your lecture or anything like that, is there a website out there that people can go to?
I think the Nobel Prize people, they are very, very professional at this. And so they don't give you the money that you're supposed to get when you get the prize until you give them the words, the text of the lecture. So if you look on the Nobel website, you can look up the lecture and the biography of every Nobel Prize winner that exists. And obviously they have a formula now. And so I thought this was a good opportunity. So I actually spent quite a long time writing mine, actually.
Well, again, thanks so much. I appreciate you coming on. And this has been great. And I had a great time listening and talking to you about science and everything else. So I really appreciate it. The St. Andrews Society of Los Angeles appreciates it as well.
Thank you so much for listening to the St. Andrews Society of Los Angeles podcast. For more information on the St. Andrews Society of Los Angeles, visit www.standrewsla.org. And don't forget to like our Facebook page, Instagram, and YouTube channels as well. Have a great week, and we'll see you next episode.